hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe the fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me. Yeah, walking on the fight inside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fought and doubt key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my countryman, you're walking on the fight inside me. Yeah, walking on the fight. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run it down, my countryman, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Going to play the program I recorded yesterday with William Johnson and Ken Givedan. This is the our weekly show called the Ethno State. And I hope you catch it. Hope you like this when we talk a number of things, including when to decline media interviews.
William Pierce, there are all sorts.
And we just wanted to start that off a little bit farther back.
Hello, everyone. This is William Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party, here with another edition of The Ethno State with our distinguished and usual panelist, Paul Fromm from Canada and Ken Givedan from Indianapolis. Thank you guys for being here with us today. In 1985, I attended an Area Nations Congress where I was giving a speech on a book that I'd written called The Pace Amendment. And there I spoke with William Pierce. There were all sorts of interviewers, television, newspaper, everybody didn't have the internet back then, were all clamoring to talk with William Pierce, and William Pierce would not talk with any of them. So I asked him, well, why don't you do that? He says, well, the news media is only the opposition. They don't put anything right. I don't do any speaking to any of the media. It never helps at all. So I followed that advice for maybe 20 years. And then I started doing a lot of interviews, and I have not been disappointed with the interviews that I got. About a half an hour ago, I got a telephone call from NBC, who's doing a pilot program. And of course, whenever the assistant producer talks to you, they always butter you up. They say, "Oh, we want to hear your views. Get your views out." And you know, of course, who knows what it's actually going to be? But they're going to. I'm going to talk with them tomorrow to see about setting up something for them to have a long interview with me. My question to you guys here, and is, should I do this, or what do you think I should do on that? And I know the reason why this came to mind is, Ken, you just said that you were did an interview on past pastorships and being a preacher. And so what's your opinion on, well, first of all, Ken, why don't you tell me about what you were interviewed with just a little while ago, and then we'll go into the question of should we have done these interviews?
Well, yeah, this was a guy who is, it's really kind of unrelated to what we're doing, but he's doing a doctorate, and part of his research is interviewing pastors who are no longer in the pastorate. So, essentially, he's interviewing people who have, quote, left the faith, unquote. What happened, you know? So, excuse me just a second, I need to... But, yeah, it was a good interview. But my opinion is, sure, Bill, go for it. Talk to these people.
What do they want to talk to you about?
It's a pilot show, so they're not even sure whether they can sell it or not. It's the putting it together to try to sell it to NBC, and they wouldn't give me much of the details. They're supposedly giving more information tomorrow, but apparently it's a therapist, a therapist who wants to interview maybe like a doctor, I forget, that bald-headed guy that's on TV, who just interviewed all different sort of people and get their views out, but maybe they want me to lie on a couch and exercise my demons.
Dr. Phil.
I don't know. But, Paul, do you do show, do you do interviews, or do you turn them away?
No, I'll talk to anybody. I'm not... It's not without being conflicted about it, but my experience is that sometimes something good comes of it. Some of our ideas do get out. I don't agree with the notion any publicity is good publicity. Just make sure you spell my name right. I went through a protracted misery of 6 years. Being fired by my Board of Education employer after a lot of agitation by the Jewish lobby. It was a slow process of there'd be a burst of publicity, then things would be quiet for a few months. Much of the publicity was extremely hostile, you know, the throwing around the usual terms of associated with, you know, white supremacists and all that type of stuff. I almost thought, well, look, intelligent people will read between the lines, and they'll say, "Well, I kind of agree with what that guy said," and even though there's a lot of weaponized words being used there. Well, my experience over those 6 years was this: I got exactly 4 phone calls from people who were not my political friends. Like one of my political friends were great; the support was fantastic. But anyway, but these are free. There are 4 people from the general community. 2 were hostile with, you know, lots of obscene words and so on. 2 were supportive, but I never met those people. They never joined. They never got further involved. And what I had to conclude from that was that type of publicity, while people may quietly support you, they've already seen what's being done to you for your views. And so they decide, well, I don't want to get too close to that guy. I don't want that being done to me. So that may not exactly be an answer to your question. I think by talking to the press, you do get some stuff filters out there. And sometimes it's not too bad.
Well, I remember a few years ago, I appeared on a show. It was called Brand X. And it was by Russell Brand, who I think was very popular a few years ago. He was like a recovering heroin addict, and he had a TV show, and don't ask me why. But when I went there, they took me to the studios, and they buttered me up. They were the nicest, friendliest people, saying, "We want to get your views out. We understand your views." And of course, I knew it was all blather, and that, you know, it was just all smokescreen. But I thought, well, you know, they're very nice, very friendly. And then they put, just before they put me on stage, they start talking to the audience, and they're telling the audience who this is going to be, and they were just, he was just excoriating me, saying all the bad things up on me, and then they put up on the screen where he says, well, we believe that our positions are just, moral, and proper, and the stuff, the quote that he put on the screen for me, it was very favorable, and I thought, well, at least that's going to be right in my favor. So then they pull me out, and then I see that they took down that thing, because I guess the producer read that, they didn't want to say anything positive. And it was the next half an hour of just ballyhoo, making fun of me and teasing me and doing all sorts of obscene gestures at me. But, you know, I got the word out a little bit. And then also in previous times, they have pulled me on stage where I'm sitting in the middle in a business suit. You've got someone in a Klan uniform on my left and someone in a Nazi uniform on my right, you know, and I'm trying to be serious in my discussions. And then the next, you know, after it airs, I go to a party with one of my clients, and one of my clients' general manager's wife says, "Hey, Mr. Johnson, we saw you on TV." And so, you know, we got to take these different incidents with a grain of salt. But I'm going to do it. And my goal is that I'm going to try to help them put together the best show that they're going to try to sell, to try to make it so it sells. You know, I want them to succeed no matter what they try to do with me. So that's what I'm going to do. There's another issue before we get to the topics at hand that happened. Oh, gee, it was Monday. It happened yesterday that I need to tell you about, but I need to go way back. In the early 1980s, or the mid-1980s, I guess it was, I had to go meet at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel with some clients. Now, the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel is the oldest continually operated hotel in Los Angeles. And it was founded by Mary Pickford and Sid Grauman and Douglas Fairbanks and Louis Mayer of MGM. And it was a very important hotel, even as recently as in the 80s and even now. And one of my clients, a large Japanese company, wanted to buy a big old statue, a bronze statue on display in the lobby of the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. It was worth many hundreds of thousands of dollars, or maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars. And so I was going in there, and I was running late for my meeting. And I was so upset that I was so late, and the guy right in front of me was just dilly-dallying, going as slow as he possibly could. And I was so mad at him, I just banged on my horn, and he pulled into the same hotel parking lot as I did. I get out there and I see that he is the artist trying to sell the statue to my client. So I realized at that time, when you're within two blocks of the place you're going, you don't honk your horn. It worked out in that I was from the position of power because we were buying and he was selling, but still it was very embarrassing. Fast forward a few years, and I had a client in Las Vegas who were doing a big old discussions at a big old convention, and I was a lawyer. And
trying to sell the statue to my client.
Okay, and so in any event, I got into an elevator in Las Vegas, and there was this interracial couple, and I just gave them the dirtiest look. It was Japanese and white, and they knew I'd give them the dirtiest look, and then the Japanese client of mine said, okay, now everybody, you need to incorporate if you're going to work with us, so go see Mr. Johnson. And the first couple that came see me was this couple, this interracial couple that I glared at in the hotel elevator, and I realized, okay, I got to stop glaring at people when I'm in the place where I'm going to be. Do I learn my lesson? No. yesterday, on Monday, I had to meet with a client. I mean, I meet with an individual who contacted me several times. He'd written a book on white discrimination and how we can do it to stop the discrimination against the white people and how the white people are so oppressed now. And he called me several times to meet me. So I said, okay, I'll meet you for breakfast. And I met him on Memorial Day because it'd be easy traffic. So I go there and he's running late. He texts me or emails. He says, I'm going to be about half an hour late or whatever. So I'm sitting there, and then in walks this man with a Filipino wife. They walk through there, and they walk past me, and I thought, I didn't get a chance to glare at them. I was so upset that I missed the chance to glare at them. And then I'm sitting there, and I get a phone call, and I pick up the phone. He says, "Are you Mr. Johnson? We're already in the restaurant." And look at, and it's this guy that I didn't get a chance to glare at, that wanted to meet with me, that wrote a book on how to stop white discrimination, and he's there with his Filipino wife. So
the guy who made a video, was it?
Well, no, he hadn't made a video. He just wrote a book, and I read the book, and I mean, I looked at the book, and there was all sorts of typos in there. But the other component of this is. The American Freedom Party had a youth group that was going quite well, and the head of the youth group was a young white kid that was married to a Mexican. And when they found out that, it fell all apart. My question to you guys, why is it that it seems like these people that are interracially married, they're pro-white, they want to support the right race, but they interracially marry? What is going on?
Well, we got Tom in the room. Do you want to hear from Tom?
Let's hear from Tom.
Kozinski?
How you guys doing? Sorry, we had a little bit of a technical mix-up, but I'm happy to be here with you guys and jump in. I've been following along for the last 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. We just had a little trouble getting in the room, so glad to be here.
Very good. Well, Tom, give your answer. Have you run into people? Why is it? I've run into many cases. In fact, this Derbyshire, who also appears at Amran, I think that's his name, he's married to a Chinese woman. Yeah. And you got all sorts of these white people married to non-whites having mixed race kids trying to save the white race. And that to me is just the screwiest thing. Reach inside their heads and justify it for me.
The movie producer of the movie, a Conversation About Race, or you know him?
No.
He's same situation. It's a very good movie, and he's married to a Filipina.
Yeah. Pinoy. If they're in the United States, a Filipino living in the United States called Pinoy.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were talking vulgar.
No. But yeah, it's not only that, you have this, there's a very popular guy, very conservative on one of the mainstream television stations who's married to a Mexican gal. I forget his name, he's quite old. But it happens all the time.
If I could offer one observation, at least of some younger guys, I think that part of it might be the impact that feminism has had on destroying femininity in Western culture. And when you look at men who are attracted to women from these foreign cultures, I don't know if it's necessarily because of appearance, so much as it is finding women who behave more like women than we sometimes see exist in the West.
Well, I think there's something in that. I see a fair number of interracial couples in my travels, particularly in Toronto and Vancouver, and you almost without exception, if it's the woman's Oriental, she doesn't look like a feminist wearing a camouflage and a buzz haircut and that type of thing. They get both the Filipinas and the Japanese and the Chinese tend to be. At least present as far more.
Yeah, but there's so many virtuous, wonderful, beautiful white women who
are
beautiful white children, and these guys who are racially conscious ignore the most basic, fundamental necessity of preserving our race. It just boggles my mind. But
I think it's worth including also that a lot of young men who are conscious aren't necessarily good at presenting themselves in a larger environment. I mean, if you're dealing with guys under the age of 40 today, overwhelmingly you see these social pressures put on women to go ahead and embrace diversity. And instead, a lot of the people who are most race conscious, like within the alt-right, for instance, struggle the most to attract women because what happens, and I've seen this with several people in the movement, frankly, is that, there will be social pressures put against them, and women are always pushing one another to conform to social expectations. So a lot of the men end up being alone specifically because of these views. So it kind of works both directions, and that frustration that grows, I think, also alienates the young men where they start looking elsewhere.
I think also it's, again, without telling tales out of school, but in some of the white nationalist circles that I've been involved in myself in the United States, some of the major leaders have have never been married, and are not that they're with non-white women, but they've never been married, and obviously they don't have children. Even at a more mature level in terms of years, I think a lot of people don't see the strategy that Boyden talks about, which perhaps comes out of his religious background, that part of our duty is to propagate the race. I think when you're younger, maybe your highest goal is in this area could be defined to me. Propagating the race is...
Well, now, one of the reasons why I'm most critical of just the conservative movement is for whenever they talk about Clarence Thomas. You know, they all praise him because he's conservative, but he's married to a white woman. And that doesn't seem to bother them, or they ignore it. And that I'm really critical of that. But now I look at people in our own movement, and they're doing the same thing. So it's just sad. In any event, that was my rant. Let's move on to some of the topics that we want to discuss today. The first one is about Clarence Thomas. So there we go, Ken. Tell us what this is all about.
Well, this is a story that quotes Clarence Thomas regarding abortion. And what he said, in effect, was that abortion, as it stands in Indiana, not by fault of Indiana, but by fault of the lower court, allows people to have abortions based on race. So he thinks that's effectively an open door to eugenics. So we have a law in Indiana signed by Mike Pence when he was governor that says, no, you cannot abort a baby because it's black or white or whatever, or because of its gender, or because of a physical handicap. And the lower court overturned that, went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, we're not going to touch it. So it stands. So Clarence Thomas was commenting on that.
So it stands. What stands? That it was thrown out? I mean, that you... I'm sorry. Tell me again. What stands? What is the law that is standing?
Okay. The law is... it was a court ruling that is standing, not the law. The court ruling was that the law was unconstitutional. So the end result is, in Indiana, you can have an abortion because your baby's the wrong color.
Got it. All right. So this is a sensitive topic. We got a bunch of Christians in the room, and so tell me what you guys think of this. Let's start with Canada.
I'm in favor of eugenics in a general way. So let me see. It is unconstitutional to abort the baby because it's the wrong color. But if you had something to do with it...
No, it's unconstitutional to ban the abortion, to stop the abortion based upon the wrong color. Isn't that right, Ken?
My understanding is you can kill the baby because it's black, if you want to.
Got it. Okay, you know, this is such a hot-button topic, and because my views have changed and my views have become hardened over time, I'm going to go first and tell you what my views are, partially because Paul Fromm stole my thunder with his statement. But when I was in high school, our teacher said, now this was during the hippie era, the free love era, the anti-war movement era, and he says, okay, as an assignment, you know, they didn't want to make the assignments too long because everyone is smoking pot. And they're saying, well, if you had to say one word or one phrase to make the world a better place, what would it be? And people wrote, you know, love or peace or brotherhood of man or no war. And I wrote eugenics. And so that didn't go over very well. But even back then, I thought, okay, eugenics is an important concept.
Can you put fried chicken together and make one word out of it?
Yeah, could be. But in any event, and my views have changed and gotten harsh over time. I guess I'm kind of like now with, who was it, Joshua, who fit the Battle of Jericho and shouted and put the walls down and killed every living thing in the darn city of Jericho for eugenics purposes. I kind of think that, okay, China right now has wonderful infrastructure. If you go on their They're super bullet trains. They're beautiful. They're not marked up. They're not third world cesspools. They don't have homeless people on the streets like we have here in L.A. And that's partially because they had a one child policy per family, and it was enforced. And also, in any event, I think, you know, I think that eugenics is an important component of a future of a society. And you'll, and Clarence Thomas was talking about, well, 40% of the babies that are being aborted are black, and well, then other and that's causing a, you know, an unusual disruption of their birth rate. But then white people saying, well, 60% of the abortions are white, and we want to stop all the abortions. But it's not like the people that are aborting their children shouldn't be parenting. They shouldn't be passing their genes down to the next generation if they're so messed up and such losers that, you know, I don't want to be responsible for raising their darn babies. It's like you had orphanages in like the early 1900s when you had the mass influenza epidemic and you had parents die. You had parents die in World War I or II, and the babies were good from good stock, and so you needed to have them adopted in the homes. Now, if you're going to adopt a baby, you're going to be adopting somebody who is a loser, who has loser genes, no matter, regardless of the race, if you can find a white baby anymore. And so I'm thinking that we need to have some of these policies that are aligned more with Joshua and the Battle of Jericho than some of the modern views on Christianity. That's my take on it. Comments?
Ooh.
Well, I guess I will go. For me, it's simpler. The way I look at it as a Christian is I just can't bring myself to support abortion in any position. But I do think this particular ruling is interesting because I suspect in the longer term what you will see it used is to justify and to push harder for the abortion of white children from white mothers, and that concerns me greatly. And I think the way we deal with this is to encourage, generally I think people having children is the right approach, and on encouraging our own people to have kids and have large white families is what I want to focus on, rather than running afoul of, I think, pretty basic scripture about, you know, the baby in the womb, and there's pretty clear evidence that as a Christian you would stand against that, but I understand other people take a different position on that.
Okay, but also see, just by white people having a larger birth rate and more children isn't going to reverse the destruction of society, because in Africa, for example, there's going to be 10 billion people in the next 30 years. And don't quote my numbers on that because I'm pulling it out of my hat. But in any event, you got to do something to stop the burgeoning birth rate of people who should not be reproducing. And don't get me wrong, I've gone to church every week my entire life, and I've sat through, up until in my 20s, I had to sit through 5 hours of church, and then up until last year, it was 3 hours of church. Now it's only 2 hours. But I've had to sit through all these sermons, and so my views that I've embraced, of course, I've adopted in spite of this, you know, thousands of hours of sitting there listening to sermons. But, you know, good point. What's yours, ex-Pastor Ken? What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, I do not identify as a Christian. I did for 50 years, but no longer. But I think...
Wait. When did that happen?
Probably, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago.
I have never heard that from you before.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Well, I don't talk about it, but that's the point of the interview this morning. This guy wanted to interview me, but... what was the question? What are my views in general?
Yeah, well, after I was ranting on what Clarence Thomas said, and I want to hear your views.
Well, my views are that if it's a human life, you can't take it. It's murder. You just can't. Doesn't matter who it is. But I think what we might want to do is pay attention to what, like you said, what's happening in Africa. There was a news story that came out, I think it was today I saw it, that in a village where specialists, Westerners, are there fighting the Ebola virus, the villagers are killing the specialists, the medical specialists. absolutely crazy. And my opinion is, look, just get out of there. Let them regress to the norm. South Africa, same thing. There's another story, make it to it if we have time. But smart South Africans, and I mean that literally, highly intelligent South Africans, are fleeing the country. And as a consequence, it's regressing to the norm. I have no problem with that. But as far as killing babies, I think that's the ultimate.
You're opposed to killing babies?
Yep.
Okay. I guess it takes all kinds.
It takes all kinds.
I know South Africa reasonably well, and what Ken said is right. A lot of the very talented whites are getting out, and especially in the medical field, it's difficult to find a specialist in certain areas because they've gone. They're in the United States or Canada or Europe or Russia. I think Ken talked about Africa and the population time bomb there on a previous show, and I think we ought to adopt a policy of benign neglect. They've got to get their population under control. The Negroes there have breed at the same rate they always have. That'd be 7, 8, 9 children per woman of childbearing age, depending on the country. But up until maybe 1940 or 50, of those 7 or 8 kids, 6.5 would die. So the population increase was very, very little. Along comes a goody two-shoes interventionist white medicine, and we've got to save the village and save that. And, these white doctors over there trying to combat Ebola, they get cooked for supper. But we should... They've got to make the decisions, however they come to those decisions, or however they implement them, to get their numbers in balance with the environment.
Yeah, I think that maybe they're not going to do it without a little help from eugenics. But in any event...
Well, that, in a sense, is...
I think actually what might solve this is nature might. You have overpopulation, war, disease, those sorts of things spread. And to build on Paul's idea of benign neglect, if you're not involved helping solve problems over there, the problems will probably take care of themselves as nature controls. The problem is our sort of, we don't practice benign neglect, we practice, constant paternalistic interventionism. And if you stop that, I think the problem will probably solve itself rather quickly.
Well, I told you the joke before, and that I heard recently, and I thought it was so funny. What did the South Africans use for lights before candles? Electricity.
That's a good one.
So, in any event, let's go on to the next topic that's a little bit less polemic.
Yeah, before you do that, let me make one quick observation. In my lifetime, yes, the population of the United States was more than doubled. It was around something under 160 million back in 1953. Now it's more than twice that. So.
That has been almost entirely, at least over in the last 35 years. Professor Jared Hardin told me this. He used to be at the University of Santa Barbara. Since the late 70s, almost all of that population increase has been because of immigration.
Because we're racist. They want to come live with a white supremacist.
Okay, let's move on to the next topic. The next topic for discussion is Trump team basically says, I hate black people. I missed that tweet, but tell me what that's all about, Ken.
This is a commentator at MSNBC, and the story says, this is from Newsbusters, by the way, appearing as a panel member on Sunday's AM Joy, liberal MSNBC contributor Jason Johnson, black guy, spewed vitriol at several Donald Trump administration members as he called for the president's impeachment. So what's new now? Declared that Treasury Secretary Steve, how do you pronounce his name, Mnuchin, had essentially been pushed to say, I hate black people, and that had Secretary Ben Carson was exposed to be a sexist fool. Then regarding the Harriet Tubman $20 bill thing, Johnson said this, she's not only Mnuchin's basically, got Mnuchin basically to say on camera, I hate black people, They're not going to get Harriet Tubman's in 2020, but she also got Ben Carson to reveal once again that he's not only incompetent, but he's not only asleep basically three quarters of the time when he's doing his job, but is also a sexist fool. So this guy's nuts.
There's so much to talk about here. Anybody want to go first? Well, okay, I will. First of all, I remember watching Trump for decades, and I'd see him sitting in a boxing match with that pointy-haired guy that was convicted of murder. What was his name? King. I forget his first name. Who are we talking about? That boxing promoter?
Don King.
And he's just chumming with all the blacks. He's been chumming with blacks for 30 years. And so the only reason the blacks are now coming out saying they don't like Trump is because Trump is starting to take away some of their free perks. You know, so I don't know. That's much my first comment.
I think, yeah, I'm going to build on a different part of it, the part with Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. That never made sense to me. I mean, you know, you should preserve, you know, your currency if you're going to put anyone on it for people who've had great accomplishments. And this sort of idea where we constantly need to diversify everything by including every group in any sort of panel is one that should be imposed. I think Steve Mnuchin did well. And even though I think Andrew Jackson would be livid to be on federal bank currency, considering his own history, I certainly don't think that Harriet Tubman is the answer.
Now, I agree with that. We've had exactly the same thing in Canada. On the back of our $10 bill, we had the portrait of the first prime minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, who basically united the country. Well, that's being dropped, and now we have some no-account Negress from Nova Scotia who apparently in 1950 refused, though she was charged for being in the wrong section of a theater. There's a colored section of the theater up on the balcony. Anyway, she went down into the mezzanine, and she was cited, given a small ticket, and she fought it. And then she moved to the United States for most of her adult life, as she was a hairdresser or a beautician or something, and in late in life came back and collected Canada pension in Canada. Those were her achievements. Absolutely no achievement. A woman is on the has replaced a man who, you know, through force of will, built a country. It's absurd. I'm glad you have a Secretary of the Treasury that has more common sense than our trust fund kid prime minister.
There is somebody who has invented a rubber stamp with Tubman's image on it, and you can take that rubber stamp and stamp it on the $20 bill. I think that's a good idea. Let's make some rubber stamps of, Donald Trump and stamp him on the $20 bill. I think it's probably illegal to do that, but hey, it's a good idea.
Yes, defacing currency. But in any event,
Counselor?
Yeah, defacing currency is a crime. But in any event, I mean, I just read a week or two ago that Miss America, Miss Universe, Miss America Teen, they're all black girls. You know, when are we going to get over this? If they want to recognize Harriet Tubman, then take some of the Martin Luther King Jr. streets or boulevards and make it Harriet Tubman Boulevard. You know, that would be an accomplishment. But in any event, I remember when this question was posed at the one of the debates, who should be replacing him on the $20 bill? And a number of them said Harriet Tubman. And that was the first time I heard of that, and that kind of worried me. But that gave me some positive thought. Who would I, if I was going to replace a $20 bill with a woman, what woman would it be? Because that was the question. And I thought, you know, I remember going to Temple Square in Salt Lake City, and you had these wonderful statues of mothers holding babies, these bronze statues of a mother holding a baby. And you have these portraits of a mother holding a child in her arms or in her hands. And I thought, well, that would be a good change if they're going to change it. Just a generic white woman being a nurturing mother. That, I think, would be a progress. although I do like Jackson more than about anyone else, and I never thought about the fact that he wouldn't want to be on the $20 bill. And so, Tom, that was a clever comment. But that's my thoughts. Any other comments on this criticism of Donald Trump for hating blacks?
Well, if cryptocurrency takes hold, we may not have to worry about that particular topic.
Yeah, could be. All right, let's move on to the next topic. The next topic is pastor denounces straight white men during commencement prayer. Okay, Ken, tell us about that.
This is a guy who is noted for his left-wing leanings. Okay, I shouldn't say leanings, he's flat out left-wing. So the story is from The Blaze, a left-wing pastor from a progressive church. Why do they call him progressive? They're the exact opposite. Denounced straight white men in his commencement benediction last week at Baylor University.
University? The commencement at Baylor?
Yep. Frustrating, isn't it? The guy's name, Don Freemeyer, pastor of missional engagement, whatever that is. Had to probably something like social studies or something, at Broadway Baptist Church in Fort Worth, which calls itself fully affirming of women in lay and provisional ministry roles and fully inclusive of LGBTQ+. Always got to read that slowly because I don't know what letters they may have added.
Well, they keep adding them too.
Yeah, and got in a mention of the graduates' privileges during his prayer Saturday morning, along with an environmental appeal, before turning his attention to skin color. So, one more quote from this guy, and God, this is his prayer, and God give them the moral imagination to reject the old keys that we are trying to give them to a planet that we're poisoning by ruining it on fossil fuels and misplaced priority. A planet with too many straight white men like me behind the steering wheel, while others have been expected to sit quietly at the back of the bus. End of quote. A nice touch would have been if the guy had died of a heart attack as soon as he said that, but that didn't happen. Or struck with lightning.
Well, probably.
Or ended his sermon by saying, and I'm a Christian. And a bolt of lightning had hit him.
Probably the student body clapped and cheered. Oh, well, this was a prayer, so they probably commencement is a prayer, right? Or the speech?
Yep, it was a prayer.
It was a prayer. Yeah. Well, I don't think we have a prayer in this country. That kind of stuff's going on.
Yeah, but they may have said amen or something. I don't know.
Yeah, a couple of things comes to mind. One of my daughters was in high school. She was shooting a film, so I had to take her to the local Unitarian church where they go inside where they're going to film it. And inside the Unitarian church, they didn't have a picture of Jesus. They had a picture of Ralph Waldo Emerson on there. So that shows where they come from. But on the marquee outside, it says, "We welcome LGBTQ immigrants, women, people of color." So they mentioned everything except white men, you know, or white people.
Or and people thought, with MAGA hats, or people who are Confederates. Yeah.
But this was when I think my oldest daughter was in high school, so this was probably, 10 years ago. And, you know, that's still what, that still attitude has not changed at all. And then, just today, and I know this is going to be a shock bomb because of the music you listen to, but Eminem just came out and said that he doesn't like himself. He wants to kill himself because he's white and he's ashamed of his race. So you're going to have to turn off all that white rap you've been listening to on, in your car.
I think you ought to be encouraged to do it. Don't talk about it. If Eminem, if you really hate yourself that much, off yourself. Do so, by all means. But the problem with these people, like all the ones, the stars that were going to leave the United States if Trump got elected, Miley Cyrus, who's a complete skank, and various others, they didn't leave. I mean, I thought they were heading to Canada, but they didn't. This is just posturing, you know, I think.
Well, the thing I hate with this, though, is that for so many years, I've been in right-wing churches, and they'll always say we're afraid of having our IRS exemption or 501c3 status removed if we ever talk anything political. And the left goes ahead and they get control of government and they use the IRS to punish people who speak right-wing ideas or who support right-wing candidates. So they don't even have to go that far. We should go ahead and apply the same standard to them. They have no business giving messages like this that have nothing to do with Christianity, that are basically just pure propaganda, you know, progressive crap from the pulpit that is not Christian. It's overtly political, and I think we should go ahead and play just as rough with them as they do with us. And it's shameful that we don't.
Like, yeah. A lot of the comments that pastor made, they should be called out on this. Okay, too many white men are driving in the driver's seats, and too many people, non-whites, are in the back of the bus. Okay, he was big about the problem of the environment. Does he want to replace the decision makers running China and India and places like Indonesia? Does he want to have them making the big decisions about the environment or white people? A lot of that environmental stuff I think is nonsense, but if we're talking about pollution, we saw the errors of our way, the error of our ways, and we cleaned up a lot of the rivers and the lakes that we polluted. We don't allow, in most cases, factories to dump untreated waste into our water supply. It's white people that do that. The rivers of China and India are absolute cesspools. I think people like that pastor should be called out on this nonsense. They're talking just crap.
I remember the first time I saw this argument made by a white man saying, oh, I'm ashamed to be white. Whites have done so many bad things. He was being interviewed by an interviewer, which, of course, in America, all interviewers now are non-white. All talk show hosts and basically the commentators, they're all basically non-white. But in any event, this one non-white guy was interviewing him, and he was spewing this all this anti-white stuff, being ashamed of, he's a white, pasty old white. I can't wait till these pasty old white men are gone. And in shock that someone would be so stupid as to hate himself so much to say that. And if you look back in past eras, we shake our heads at people who punished Galileo for, you know, claiming that the Earth was not the center of the universe, or that the people are saying you can't sail around the world, you'll fall off the edge of the ocean, and because the world is flat. And we thought, how could these people have been so stupid? Well, we're going to look back in three or four generations, and they're going to say, how can that person at Baylor be so stupid to make that comment?
But I think he's saying that. You know what, I don't know what it's like in the United States on this issue about the Native Indians, but we've had an orgy of guilt the last 4 or 5 years on the whole issue of the of settlement and so on. And you'll hear people go on about, actually a lot of public meetings now begin with some sort of ritualistic, and this evening we meet on the unceded territory of the blah, blah, blah tribe of Indians, and there's a lot of... Well, we stole the land and all that. And I've actually confronted a couple of people who've been going on in this fashion and said to them, you really believe that? Do you believe that? Oh, yes, we stole the country. And I said, Ben, where did your people come from? Oh, well, 3 generations ago from England. I said, well, if you really believe that, why don't you go back, take the deed to your house if you have one, and sign it over to the local Indian band. Because otherwise, you're basically just full of, nonsense.
The problem is, Paul, that requires them to engage their brains. And yeah. they won't do it. They won't.
The bigger issue is that for generations now, or at least a couple of generations, and the generation is... used to be 20 years, now it's probably 25 years, whites have been profoundly afraid to mention their whiteness. For many years, whenever I'd be in a room and I'd talk about, oh, this community is white, there's a lot of white people, or look at these beautiful, there's a lot of beautiful white children, the people would flush red and they would get ashamed and be afraid to talk about it. You can't mention observationally that someone is white. Or if you talk to somebody who is, you know, or you're trying to describe somebody in a room of white people and say, oh, it's that person over there in the red shirt. And it's an Oriental person or an Asian person. You can't say, oh, it's the Asian over there. You say, oh, it's the person in the red shirt. Which one? There's two persons in red shirts. Oh, the one that's shorter than the other or whatever. It's just silly that for so long you couldn't even mention race.
Or and a boxing that, match. They identify the guy by the color of his
I know.
Shirts.
That's so crazy. And also for years when you'd be in a store and most of the people were non-white, and another person was white, and you'd walk by there, you would ignore that person. Slowly, we're seeing changes. We're seeing people being comfortable with their whiteness, being comfortable pointing out whiteness, noticing it. And when you see a person in, I've noticed now in these stores now, you see another white person. I mean, it's not like the black says, "How you doing, brother?" You know, and yeah, but it's just kind of a nod, or it's as a opposed to refusing to recognize any difference in race. So incrementally, we're moving in the right direction, and this Baylor preacher is certainly on the wrong side of history. And I've heard us being on the wrong side of history for 40 years, but now it's switching, and we're going to be on the right side of history. We're going to say, I was a white national before white nationalism was cool. So, whatever.
By the way, before we go to the next story, don't mean to hijack your show, Bill, but I'd kind of like to hear from Tom, his activism, and what he's doing there.
I'm in charge of this show, so I'm going to run it. Tom, tell us about your activism and what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Bill. I'm glad Ken was, you put him in his place. That's a good job there.
Good job.
The show properly. Actually, I've been busy. I was down at the Maine State House opposing an effort to turn Maine into a sanctuary state, which is an absolute terrible thing that we think will increase drug trafficking and the flow of illegal immigrants into Maine. We had the misfortune of electing all Democrats in recently after Governor Paul LePage left, and it has basically been the culture war brought up to warp speed. So I've started a group called Maine for Mainers. We're up to 150 members now and growing all the time with people who just want common sense solutions and don't think they need to be replaced. So that's pretty exciting. And this weekend I will actually be out in southern Maine. We are having a protest at a children's bookstore where they're going to be having the drag queen story hour, and a whole bunch of people who think that's inappropriate telling sexualization that 3 to 8 year olds will be out there, and who knows, it may even get a little rowdy. Some of the Antifa people down in Portland say they're going to come up, and we're showing up either way. So we'll see.
Let me interject here. I saw an article recently about that where people wearing clown suits and saying honk honk to protest it. Was that you?
Was that it wasn't group? Me, but I agree. We're living in clown world.
are you guys going to do that? I think that was. I thought that was kind of clever where they put on this. That multicolored clown and hat and a red nose, and they had.
I think there are a bunch of different people coming down to serve witness to it. I am sure some people will do some funny things. Frankly, I don't know what everyone is going to do, but it's a unique opportunity in that Waterville actually has a mayor that is much more friendly to sanity. I'm not saying he's our guy, but he's not a total leftist. They actually tried to have him removed from office a few years ago because he opposed a gun ban. So he's not very sympathetic to the left. And I think we'll have a fair opportunity to put a message out there. So I've been doing that, writing books and actually pushing peak polarization. I think people need to get aware of the fact that democracy and demography are leading us to a very dark place we don't want to be in. So that's what I do.
Okay, you have given me a phrase that I'm going to use from here on out. This person is more friendly to sanity. That's a phrase I'm gonna appropriate for myself. And if anybody says, "Where did you learn that?" I said, "Well, I invented it. I made that up." So, very good. Okay, so let's go on to the next topic. Asians benefit from white privilege. Tell us about that one, Ken.
Okay, this is a some kind of a program that was sponsored by the Department of the DOE, whatever that is, Department of, what is that?
Education.
Yeah, Department of Education. So the city DOE sponsored panel designed to combat racism, this is New York Post, told parents that Asian American students benefit from white supremacy and proximity to white privilege. I agree with them in principle, I just don't care for those terms. The comments drew backlash from some parents and Asian activists, but not the Department of Education. So the story goes on, and effectively it says that white people have more opportunities than black people in education, that racism is running rampant, but they forgot to mention Asians. And so the Asians who are on top, who tend to be more talented, more gifted scholastically than white people, totally left out. So they're all upset because they're invisible. They were lumped in with white people. But that's essentially the story, is they're all upset because white people are outperforming black people in education, academically.
One thing that bothers me is the term Asian. It's too broad a term. When I read about Asian in Canada or in England, all the bad things, the rapes and the murders that Asians do, they're not talking about the Asians that we consider over here to be Asians. We consider Asians to be Chinese, Japanese, Korean, but over there in England and probably in Canada, they're talking about Pakistanis and people from the subcontinent. So my first comment is we got to come up with a little more precise definitions here. And also, the people that they lump in with whites, they call people from the Middle East white, and that bugs me too. So the first comment is I would like to define who is what.
Yeah, I use the term East Asian.
Yeah, in Canada, the Indian, Eastern people from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, etc., are called East Indians. Now in England, they're called Asians, and when they talk about Asian crime in England, it usually is referring to Pakistanis and the.
They're talking,
I agree with the president. It's important to be precise.
Yep. Yeah, but then also, I do believe that the most white supremacist of any group in America are the Asians. They want to marry white people. They want to live around white people. They want to act like white people. And so I think that white people generally are blind to race. They've had it beaten out of them, but the Asians, they look at race as what it is, and they all want to be white. So I can understand the concept that, you know, they're white wannabes, and so they benefit from white supremacy. That's my comment.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a very mischievous term, a white supremacy. When people denounce it, you know, that's white supremacy, or they don't like white supremacists, and they'll label you that. I like to flip it around and say, well, okay, what do you want? Do you want whites to be inferior? I think that puts them in a spot. But in terms of, you know, what you just said about the ambitions of Asians, and I would say this about immigration in general, we don't have to say we're the best, or we're the most in achievements. The world says that. They're not. Nobody in Africa or Asia is beating a trail to emigrate to Haiti, or to Gabon, or to Burkina Faso. They all want to come to the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
And they want to go to Maine, is what they want to do.
Watch
out, Tom. And unfortunately, Catholic Charities is paving the way up here. So disgusting.
Yeah, by the way, we should say it, even though we don't say it. It's said implicitly by people who want to live with us, but we need to say it explicitly, because why not? It's just reality. It's just true. That doesn't mean we hate anybody, want to hurt anybody, but white people did, in fact, invent just about everything. So let's take credit for it. We're not trying to hurt anybody, but reality is what it is.
Also, I get profoundly jealous when people go and when you go and visit Nepal, and everybody there is Nepalese. If you go to the Philippines, and they're all Filipino.